Branford, could you tell me how working with Art Blakey helped you develop as a saxophonist and as a musician?
Well, when I first, not really as a saxophonist, he didn't really do a lot, but as a jazz musician, he was really instrumental. Because when I joined Blakey's band, I really didn't know anything about jazz. I was more of an R&B saxophone player. And he was the guy that was really taught me what to listen to, how to listen to it. It was quite impressive, actually. His level of intelligence was often, not really discussed, you know. And he was a smart, smart musician, and he understood the music from the ground up. And it was very good for me to be around that. I learned a lot about how to think in jazz terms from Art.
Could you share with us your thoughts about David S. Ware, who recently passed away? He was a great saxophonist.
Yeah, I was a big David S. Ware fan, mostly because my experiences with what they call avant-garde jazz were that the people who played it best were the ones who understood the music from the traditional sense. And the thing that knocked me out about David is that no matter how, for lack of a better word, out you thought that the songs were, you could always hear melodies in his playing. And it wasn't just sound effect playing. You could always hear melodies, and you could always hear a sense of direction and song form, which is quite amazing when you think about the style of the music. And that was one of the things that always knocked me out about him.
Branford, could you tell me more about your drummer, Justin Faulkner?
I first heard him play when he was 16 years old. He joined the band when he was 18 years old. And he's grown in leaps and bounds. It's just, he's one of those rare talents where he's super intelligent musically. So he's developing his drum chops, but also he's developing a concept on how to play songs and how to play with us and how to play with other musicians. He's a sponge. He asks a ton of questions. And he's just fun to be around.
And will you be bringing Justin and the rest of the band to the Holland for the show on Friday night?
I think so, yeah. Unless there's something I'm not being told, yeah, I think they'll be there.
From the latest record, could you go into detail about Maestra?
Yeah, that's Eric's tune, and I'd never played it before. He brought it into the session, and we were playing it, and I'm saying, yeah, it's not working. It's not working. It works, but it just sounds regular. What can we do to make it not sound so regular? And then Joey said, well, maybe if I played the first half of the melody. And I said, yeah, man. I mean, that's kind of how we do. We talk about songs. And I said, well, I'm not feeling this. What can we do to make it better? And then the conversation begins. And Joey played the first half of the melody. I came in on the back part. And it's just one of those things where you have to try to play as few notes as possible and play with more space to make it more effective.
I was really struck by the tune Teo from the latest record. How did that come about?
The way it came about is my brother Delphio was playing, we brought in the arrangement. We did a family record a few years ago, and he brought in the song Teo, and I'd never heard the song before. And he brought it in, and he had arranged it in a traditional jazz way, in AABA song form. And when I heard Monk's version, it was ABA song form. So I was already intrigued that it had that different feeling to it. And when we started playing it, we were going to play it in the way that Monk played it. And it just evolved. The slower we played it, the more funky and the more swinging it was. So we just kept getting slower and slower, and it's just one of those great songs. Monk is probably is one of the few real jazz composers that we have. Ellington is another one. Strayhorn's another one, but he's really a jazz composer, because a lot of people say, why are you guys always playing Monk tunes? They're jazz songs. They're not, you know. When Gershwin was writing his songs, he wasn't thinking, boy, Dizzy's going to kill this when he gets a hold of it. He was writing pop tunes. You know, his focus was to have them played on Broadway stages. And I'm sure he was flattered when jazz guys played his songs, but that really wasn't his goal at have jazz guys play it, whereas Monk's songs were written for jazz folk to do them. And that's really, it really shows to me. It really shows. And I enjoy playing his songs because I always learn something from them.
Ranford, I really enjoyed As Summer Into Autumn Slips. The development of the melody was sublime.
Yeah, Joey wrote that song. He says, I got this great song. I haven't written it out yet. So I said, well, we need another ballad, so we'll take an hour and we'll let you write it out. And he wrote it out, and we just kind of played through it. And we did two takes in the first take. Originally, when we were doing the first take, I wasn't going to play a solo because I'm kind of in this place where I believe solos are cool but not really important, which is the opposite of the way that I think that a lot of jazz musicians think today. It just took on. It was a life of its own. It just became its own thing, you know. And by the second take, we had it done. We had it done. And Revis is the star of the show on that song because he just played the bass line, ostinato bass line, same part over and over and over again. And if he had tried to do what a lot of musicians tend to do is think that he has something to play that's hipper than what's written, the song definitely would not have worked as well as it worked. The fact that he was able to have the discipline to just play that same part over and over again was really, really, really effective in making the song what it was.
Do you think that some jazz musicians tend to intellectualize jazz to an extreme?
Well, I think that it's intellectual, and it should be intellectualized, but there should also be an emotional side to it, and there should be an understanding that they're often playing for people who are just regular lay folk. And I think that the obsession is with newness and innovation. And all the musicians feel that they have to, quote unquote, innovate. And they don't look at it in a very logical or sanguine way. The way I look at innovation is that in the history of classical music, which is 800 years, or probably 1,000, but it's 800 just for the sake of argument. I talked to some of my students about it. I said, how many composers do you think that there were in Europe in 800 years? 200,000, 300,000, just composers. And even if we said 50,000, but it's clearly more than 50,000 in 800 years, you know. So, and of all those composers, how many do we talk about? Five. And in some respects, you could say 20. And that's what innovation is. And that's not anything that you can control. The idea that you have people fashioning themselves as innovators as though it's like saying you're going to be 7 feet tall one day. That may be a desire, but there's no way that you can actually guarantee that. The only thing you can guarantee is the process, is working on the process and trying to get it as good as you can get it. And a lot of musicians are eschewing the process and spending all of their time trying to invent music, and this is when the intellectualism kind of takes over and makes it really difficult for people to understand or enjoy the music. And we just try to keep it simple in that regard. What's the emotional import of the song? Like a song like Summer in the Autumn Slips. The bass player comes in and he's trying to play a bunch of ideas and a bunch of notes, the piano player. Let's just, everybody play the part, let's keep it simple, and let the power of the song itself influence the listener. We don't need any of those, hey, look at me moments. And fortunately for me, everybody in the band is on board with that sentiment, even the young kid, and that's really rare for a 21-year-old to understand that. And just to play with such restraint is really rare.
So there are a lot of people who tend to solo without the need to solo, if I understand you correctly.
Well, they make the solo the primary aspect of the song. It's not really about needing to solo. I just think that solos shouldn't be the primary aspect of most songs. The most important aspect of a song is the melody, and it should be played with a certain level of emotional conviction. It shouldn't be, because the mentality of a musician who thinks that the solo is the most important aspect of the song, they tend to not play the melodies with the certain conviction that I think songs require. Because if you've gone to a lot of jazz concerts, you can see it where a trumpet player or a saxophone player will finish a solo. And then when he finishes his solo, he gives a scant nod to the audience, and then he stands on the side, and he's looking at his fingernails. You know, he's looking at the floor. He's not actively engaged in the music and what the other musicians are doing. And I think the music is more effective, particularly with lay people, who are not designed for and should not be designed for trying to understand everything that we do. Because it's like this, like that astrophysicist Neil Tyson deGrasse, one of the reasons that he's so popular is because he takes really difficult abstract thought and he distills it down to really pithy statements that anyone can understand. Whereas a lot of his colleagues are just really, really brilliant and really can't find a way to make those narratives simple for people. So suddenly, the concept of astronomy and the concept of space exploration and astrophysics is exciting to people because it's you have a guy who can talk to them about what these things are in real simple terms. You don't have to go to school and take physics to get the conversation. And a lot of musicians tend to be that way, where they kind of they talk about music and they play music in a fashion where if you're not a complete music nut, it just seems really cold and distant. And that's something that we're just trying to stay away from.
Well, that's very important because a lot of listeners appreciate your music and the music of classic jazz bands such as the Miles Davis Quintet without being able to explain why.
Right. And nor should they be able to explain why. They should just like it. And one of the things I like to say about instrumental music in general, because I used to make my kids listen to instrumental classical music mostly, is that when you watch a young child listening to instrumental music and you ask them what the music's about whatever they want it to be about. And that's what I think is great about instrumental music, is you have a lot of people who have the imagination side of their brain has been kind of damped down. And they expect other people to tell them what the songs are about and to tell them how to think and tell them how to feel. Songs without lyrics don't do that. And there's this famous interview with Eddie Murphy. Well, it's not really famous, but it was famous at the time, and sometime in the late 80s. And they asked him, he says, I listen to a lot of serious musicians. And the guy says, like, who? And he said, like, Wynton Marsalis. He says, Wynton Marsalis. He goes, man, I'm talking about like Prince, you know, and he says, how can music without lyrics make you think? And it was one of those great statements. It's like, yeah, how can it? You know, when he said it, I was like, that basically sums up how a lot of people feel about instrumental music. But the great thing about instrumental music is that instrumental music can make you think, and it will not tell you how to think, because it can be whatever it is that you want it to be. And it's our job to create a template that allows people to feel comfortable in feeling that way or thinking that way. And some people will never get there. They're pop music people, and they're locked down from any possibility. But then there are other people who they just need the music to speak to them in a way that it doesn't feel like it's this massive mountain to climb.